and the pound was its quasi-official medium. As David Lloyd George was later to write nostalgically, prior to 1914, the crackle of a bill on London, that is, of a bill of credit in pounds sterling, bearing the signature of a London bank, was as good as the ring of gold in any port throughout the civilized world. The war ended this idyll by disrupting the delicate balance of forces that had made it possible, and by bringing to the fore a challenger to the pound supremacy, the United States dollar. In 1914, Britain, hard-pressed to finance its fighting forces, adopted measures to discourage demands for gold, thereby abandoning the gold standard in everything but name. Meanwhile, the value of a pound in dollars sank from $4.86 to a 1920 low of $3.20. In an effort to recoup its lost glory, Britain resumed a full gold standard in 1925, tying the pound to gold at a rate that restored its old $4.86 relation to the dollar. The cost of this gallant overvaluation, however, was chronic depression at home, not to mention the political eclipse for some 15 years of the Chancellor of the Exchequer who ordered it, Winston Churchill. The general collapse of currencies during the 1930s actually began not in London, but on the continent, when, in the summer of 1931, a sudden run on the leading bank of Austria, the Kreditanstalt, resulted in its failure. The domino principle of bank failures, if such a thing can be said to exist, then came into play. German losses arising from this relatively minor disaster resulted in a banking crisis in Germany, and then, because huge quantities of British funds were now frozen in bankrupt institutions on the continent, the panic crossed the English Channel and invaded the home of the imperial pound itself. Demands for gold in exchange for pounds quickly became too heavy for the Bank of England to meet, even with the help of loans from France and the United States. Britain was faced with the bleak alternatives of setting an almost usurious bank rate, between 8% and 10%, in order to hold funds in London and check the gold outflow, or abandoning the gold standard. The first choice, which would have further depressed the domestic economy, in which there are now more than 2.5 million unemployed, was considered unconscionable. And accordingly, on September 21, 1931, the Bank of England announced suspension of its responsibility to sell gold. The move hit the financial world like a thunderbolt. So great was the prestige of the pound in 1931 that John Maynard Keynes, the already famous British economist, could say, not wholly in irony, that sterling hadn't left gold, gold had left sterling. In either case, the mooring of the old system was gone, and chaos was the result. Within a few weeks, all the countries on the vast portion of the globe, then under British political or economic domination, had left the gold standard. Most of the other leading currencies had either left gold or been drastically devalued in relation to it. And in the free market, the value of the pound in terms of dollars had dropped from $4.86 to around $3.50. Then the dollar itself, the potential new mooring, came loose. In 1933, the United States, compelled by the worst depression in its history, abandoned the gold standard. A year later, it resumed it in a modified form called the Gold Exchange Standard, under which gold coinage was ended and the Federal Reserve was pledged to sell gold in bar form to other central banks, but to no one else, and to sell it at a drastic devaluation of 41% from the old price. The United States devaluation restored the pound to its old dollar parity, but Britain found it small comfort to be tied securely to a mooring that was now shaky itself. Even so, over the next 5 years, while beggar my neighbor came to be the rule in international finance, the pound did not lose much more ground in relation to other currencies. And when the Second World War broke out, the British government boldly pegged it at $4.03, and imposed controls to keep it there, in defiance of the free market. There for a decade it remained, but only officially. In the free market of neutral Switzerland, it fluctuated all through the war, in reflection of Britain's military fortunes, sinking at the darkest moments to as low as $2. In the post-war era, the pound has been almost continuously in trouble. The new rules of the game of international finance that were agreed upon at Bretton Woods recognized that the gold standard had been far too rigid, and the virtual paper standard of the 1930s far too unstable. A compromise accordingly emerged, under which the dollar, the new king of currencies, remained tied to gold under the gold exchange standard, and the pound, along with the other leading currencies, became tied not to gold but to the dollar, at rates fixed within stated limits. Indeed, the post-war era was virtually ushered in by a devaluation of the pound that was about as drastic in amount as that of 1931, though far less so in its consequences. The pound, like most European currencies, had emerged from Bretton Woods flagrantly overvalued in relation to the shattered economy it represented, and had been kept that way only by government-imposed controls. In the autumn of 1949, therefore, after a year and a half of devaluation rumors, burgeoning black markets and sterling, and gold losses that had reduced the British reserves to a dangerously low level, the pound was devalued from $4.03 to $2.80. With the isolated exceptions of the United States dollar and the Swiss franc, every important non-communist currency almost instantly followed the pound's example. But this time, no drying up of trade or other chaos ensued, because the 1949 devaluations, unlike those of 1931 and the years following, were not the uncontrolled attempts of countries riddled by depression to gain a competitive advantage at any cost, but merely represented recognition by the war-devastated countries that they had recovered to the point where they could survive relatively free international competition without artificial props. In fact, world trade, instead of drying up, picked up sharply. But even at the new, more rational evaluation, the pound continued its career of hairbreadth escapes. Sterling crises of varying magnitudes were weathered in 1952, 1955, 1957, and 1961. In its unsentimental and tactless way, the pound, just as by its gyrations in the past it had accurately charted Britain's rise and fall as the greatest of world powers, now with its nagging recurrent weakness, seemed to be hinting that even such retrenchment as the British had undertaken in 1949 was not enough to suit their reduced circumstances. And in November 1964, these hints, with their humiliating implications, were not lost on the British people. The emotional terms in which many of them were thinking about the pound were well illustrated by an exchange that took place in that celebrated forum, the Letters Column of the Times, when the crisis was at its height. A reader named I.M.D. Little wrote deploring all the breast-beating about the pound, and particularly the uneasy whispering about devaluation, a matter that he declared to be an economic rather than a moral issue. Quick as a flash came a reply from a C.S. Hadfield, among others. "Was there ever a clearer sign of soulless times," Hadfield demanded, "than Little's letter? Devaluation not a moral issue? Repudiation, for that is what devaluation is, neither more nor less, has become respectable," Hadfield groaned, in the unmistakable tone, as old in Britain as the pound itself, of the outraged patriot. In the 10 days following the Basel meeting, the first concern of the men at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York was not the pound but the dollar. The American balance of payments deficit had now crept up to the alarming rate of almost $6 billion a year, and it was becoming clear that a rise in the British bank rate, if it should be unmatched by American action, might merely shift some of the speculative attack from the pound to the dollar. Hayes and Coombs and the Washington Monetary Authorities, William McChesney Martin, chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Secretary of the Treasury Douglas Dillon, and Under-Secretary of the Treasury Robert Rosa, came to agree that if the British should raise their rate, the Federal Reserve would be compelled, in self-defense, to competitively raise its rate above the current level of 3.5%. Hayes had numerous telephone conversations on this delicate point with his London counterpart, Lord Cromer. A deep-dyed aristocrat, a godson of King George V, and a grandson of Sir Evelyn Baring, later the first Earl of Cromer, who, as the British agent in Egypt, was Chinese Gordon's nemesis in 1884 to 1885, Lord Cromer was also a banker of universally acknowledged brilliance and, at 43, the youngest man, as far as anyone could remember, ever to direct the fortunes of the Bank of England. He and Hayes, in the course of their frequent meetings at Basel and elsewhere, had become warm friends. During the afternoon of Friday the 20th, at any rate, the Federal Reserve Bank had a chance to show its good intentions by doing some front-line fighting for the pound. The breather provided by the London closing proved to be illusory. 5 o'clock in London was only noon in New York, and insatiable speculators were able to go on selling pounds for several more hours in the New York market, with the result that the trading room of the Federal Reserve Bank temporarily replaced that of the Bank of England as the command post for the defense. Using as their ammunition British dollars, or more precisely, United States dollars lent to Britain under the swap agreements, the Federal Reserve's traders staunchly held the pound at, or above, $2.78 and 25 one-hundredths of a cent, at ever-increasing cost, of course, to the British reserves. Mercifully, after the New York closing, the battle did not follow the sun to San Francisco and on around the world to Tokyo. Evidently, the attackers had had their fill, at least for the time being. What followed was one of those strange modern weekends in which weighty matters are discussed and weighty decisions taken among men who are ostensibly sitting around relaxing in various parts of the world. Wilson, Brown, and Callahan were at Chequers, the Prime Minister's country estate, taking part in a conference that had originally been scheduled to cover the subject of national defense policy. Lord Cromer was at his country place in Westerham, Kent. Martin, Dillon, and Rosa were at their offices or their homes in and around Washington. Combs was at his home in Green Village, New Jersey, and Hayes was visiting friends of his elsewhere in New Jersey. At Chequers, Wilson and his two financial ministers, leaving the military brass to confer about defense policy with each other, adjourned to an upstairs gallery to tackle the sterling crisis. In order to bring Lord Cromer into their deliberations, they kept a telephone circuit open to him in Kent, using a scrambler system when they talked on it, so as to avoid interception of their words by their unseen enemies, the speculators. Sometime on Saturday, the British reached their decision. Not only would they raise the bank rate and raise it 2% above its current level to 7%, but in defiance of custom, they would do so the first thing Monday morning, rather than wait for another Thursday to roll around. For one thing, they reasoned, to postpone action until Thursday would mean 3.5 more business days during which the deadly drain of British reserves would almost certainly continue and might well accelerate. For another, the sheer shock of the deliberate violation of custom would serve to dramatize the government's determination. The decision, once taken, was communicated by British intermediaries in Washington to the American monetary officials there, and relayed to Hayes and Coombs in New Jersey. Those two, knowing that the agreed-upon plan for a concomitant rise in the New York bank rate would now have to be put into effect as quickly as possible, got to work on the telephone, lining up a Monday afternoon meeting of the Federal Reserve Bank's Board of Directors, without whose initiative the rate could not be changed. Hayes, a man who sets great store by politeness, has since said, with considerable chagrin, that he fears he was the despair of his hostess that weekend. Not only was he on the telephone most of the time, but he was prevented by the circumstances from giving the slightest explanation of his unseemly behavior. What had been done, or rather what was about to be done, in Britain, was plenty to flutter the dovecotes of international finance. Since the beginning of the First World War, the bank rate there had never gone higher than 7%, and had only occasionally gone that high. As for a bank rate change on a day other than Thursday, the last time that had occurred, ominously enough, was in 1931. Anticipating lively action at the London opening, which would take place at about 5 a.m. New York time, Combs went to Liberty Street on Sunday afternoon in order to spend the night at the bank and be on hand when the transatlantic doings began. As an overnight companion, he had a man who found it advisable to sleep at the bank so often that he habitually kept a packed suitcase in his office. Thomas J. Roche, at that time the senior foreign exchange officer. Roche welcomed his boss to the sleeping quarters, a row of small motel-like rooms on the 11th floor, each equipped with maple furniture, old New York prints, a telephone, a clock radio, a bathrobe, and a shaving kit. And the two men discussed the weekend's developments for a while before turning in. Shortly before 5 in the morning, the radios woke them, and, after a breakfast provided by the night staff, they repaired to the foreign exchange trading room on the 7th floor to man their fluoroscope. At 5:10, they were on the phone to the Bank of England, getting the news. The bank rate rise had been announced promptly at the opening of the London markets, to the accompaniment of great excitement. Later, Combs was to learn that the government broker's entrance into the stock exchange, which is usually the occasion for a certain hush, had this time been greeted with such an uproar that he had had difficulty making his news known. As for the first market reaction of the pound, it was, one commentator said later, like that of a racehorse to dope. In the 10 minutes following the bank rate announcement, it shot up to $2.78 and 69 one-hundredths of a cent, far above its Friday closing. A few minutes later, the early rising New Yorkers were on the phone to the Deutsche Bundesbank, the central bank of West Germany in Frankfurt, and the Swiss National Bank in Zurich, sounding out continental reaction. It was equally good. Then they were back in touch with the Bank of England, where things were looking better and better. The speculators against the pound were on the run, rushing now to cover their short sales, and by the time the first gray light began to show in the windows on Liberty Street, Combs had heard that the pound was being quoted in London at $2.79, its best price since July when the crisis started. It went on that way all day. 7% will drag money from the moon, a Swiss banker commented, paraphrasing the great Bagehot, who had said, in his earthbound Victorian way, 7% will pull gold out of the ground. In London, the sense of security was so strong that it allowed a return to political bickering as usual. In Parliament, Reginald Maudling, the chief economic authority of the out-of-office Conservatives, took the occasion to remark that there wouldn't have been a crisis in the first place, but for the actions of the Labour government. And Chancellor of the Exchequer Callaghan replied, with deadly politeness, I must remind the honourable gentleman that he told us recently we had inherited his problems. Everybody was clearly breathing easier. As for the Bank of England, so great was the sudden clamour for pounds that it saw a chance to replenish its depleted supply of dollars, and for a time that afternoon it actually felt confident enough to switch sides in the market, buying dollars with pounds at just below $2.79. In New York, the mood persisted after the London closing. It was with a clear conscience about the pound that the directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York could, and that afternoon did, carry out their plan to raise their lending rate from 3.5% to 4%. Coombs has since said, "The feeling here on Monday afternoon was, they've done it. They've pulled through again. There was a general sigh of relief. The Sterling crisis seemed to be over."
It wasn't, though. I remember that the situation changed very fast on Tuesday the 24th, Hayes has said. That day's opening found the pound looking firm, at $2.78 and 75/100 of a cent. Substantial buying orders for pounds were coming in now from Germany, and the day ahead looked satisfactory. So things continued until 6 a.m. in New York, noon on the continent. It is around then that the various bourses of Europe, including the most important ones, in Paris and Frankfurt, hold the meetings at which they set the day's rate for each currency, for the purpose of settling transactions in stocks and bonds that involve foreign currency. And these price-fixing sessions are bound to influence the money markets, since they give a clear indication of the most influential continental sentiment in regard to each currency. The bourse rates set for the pound that day were such as to show a renewed and pronounced lack of confidence. At the same time, it appeared subsequently money dealers everywhere, and particularly in Europe, were having second thoughts about the manner of the bank rate rise the previous day. At first, taken by surprise, they had reacted enthusiastically, but now, it seemed, they had belatedly decided that the making of the announcement on Monday indicated that Britain was losing its grip. What would it connote if the British were to play a cup final on Sunday? A European banker is said to have asked a colleague. The only possible answer was that it would connote panic in Albion. The effect of these second thoughts was an astonishingly drastic turnabout in market action. In New York, between 8 and 9, Coombs, in the trading room, watched with a sinking heart as a tranquil pound market collapsed into a rout. Selling orders in unheard-of quantities were coming from everywhere. The Bank of England, with the courage of desperation, advanced its last-line trench from $2.78 and 25/100 of a cent to $2.78 and 60/100 of a cent, and by constant intervention held the pound there. But it was clear that the cost would soon become too high. A few minutes after 9 a.m. New York time, Coombs calculated that Britain was losing reserves at the unprecedented and unsupportable rate of $1 million a minute. Hayes, arriving at the bank shortly after 9, had hardly sat down at his desk before this unsettling news reached him from the 7th floor. "We're in for a hurricane," Coombs told him, and went on to say that the pressure on Sterling was now mounting so fast that there was a real likelihood that Britain might be forced either to devalue or to impose a sweeping, and for many reasons unacceptable, system of exchange controls before the week was out. Hayes immediately telephoned the governors of the leading European central banks, some of whom, because not all the national markets had yet felt the full weight of the crisis, were startled to hear exactly how grave the situation was, and pleaded with them not to exacerbate the pressure on both the pound and the dollar by raising their own bank rates. His job was scarcely made easier by the fact that he had to admit that his own bank had just raised its rate. Then he asked Coombs to come up to his office. The pound, the two men agreed, now had its back to the wall. The British bank rate rise had obviously failed of its purpose, and at the million-a-minute rate of loss, Britain's well of reserves would be dry in less than 5 business days. The one hope now lay in amassing, within a matter of hours, or within a day or so at the most, a huge bundle of credit from outside Britain to enable the Bank of England to survive the attack and beat it back. Such rescue bundles had been assembled just a handful of times before, for Canada in 1962, for Italy earlier in 1964, and for Britain in 1961. But this time, it was clear, a much bigger bundle than any of those would be needed. The central banking world was faced not so much with an opportunity for building a milestone in the short history of international monetary cooperation, as with the necessity for doing so. Two other things were clear. That, in view of the dollar's troubles, the United States could not hope to rescue the pound unassisted, and that, the dollar's troubles notwithstanding, the United States, with all its economic might, would have to join the Bank of England in initiating any rescue operation. As a first step, Coombs suggested that the Federal Reserve standby credit to the Bank of England ought to be increased forthwith from $500 million to $750 million. Unfortunately, fast action on this proposal was hampered by the fact that, under the Federal Reserve Act, any such move could be made only by decision of a Federal Reserve System Committee, whose members were scattered all over the country. Hayes conferred by long-distance telephone, all around the world, wires were now humming with news of the pound's extremity, with the Washington Monetary Contingent, Martin, Dillon, and Rosa, none of whom disagreed with Coombs' view of what had to be done. And as a result of these discussions, a call went out from Martin's office to members of the key committee, called the Open Market Committee, for a meeting by telephone at 3 o'clock that afternoon. Rosa, at the Treasury, suggested that the United States contribution to the kitty could be further increased by arranging for a $250 million loan from the Export-Import Bank, a Treasury-owned and Treasury-financed institution in Washington. Hayes and Coombs were naturally in favor of this, and Rosa set in motion the bureaucratic machinery to unlock that particular vault, a process that, he warned, would certainly take until evening. As the early afternoon passed in New York, with millions of dollars continuing to drain, minute by minute from Britain's reserves, Hayes and Coombs, along with their Washington colleagues, were busy planning the next step. If the swap increase and the Export-Import Bank loan should come through, the United States credits would amount to $1 billion all told. Now in consultation with the beleaguered garrison at the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve Bank men began to believe that, in order to make the operation effective, the other leading central banks, spoken of in central banking shorthand as the continent, even though they include the banks of Canada and Japan, would have to be asked to put up additional credits on the order of $1.5 billion, or possibly even more. Such a sum would make the continent, collectively, a bigger contributor to the cause than the United States, a fact that Hayes and Coombs realized might not sit too well with the continental bankers and their governments. At 3 o'clock, the Open Market Committee held its telephone meeting. 12 men sitting at their desks in 6 cities, from New York to San Francisco. The members heard Coombs' dry, unemotional voice describing the situation and making his recommendation. They were quickly convinced. In no more than 15 minutes, they had voted unanimously to increase the swap credit to $750 million, on condition that proportional credit assistance could be obtained from other central banks. By late afternoon, tentative word had come from Washington that prospects for the Export-Import Bank loan looked good, and that more definite word could be expected before midnight. So the $1 billion in United States credit appeared to be virtually in the bag. It remained to tackle the continent. It was night now in Europe, and nobody there could be tackled. The 0 hour, then, was continental opening time the next day, and the crucial period for the fate of the pound would be the few hours after that. Hayes, after leaving instructions for a bank car to pick him up at his home in New Canaan, Connecticut, at 4 o'clock in the morning, took his usual commuting train from Grand Central shortly after 5. He has since expressed a certain regret that he proceeded in such a routine way at such a dramatic moment. "I left the bank rather reluctantly," he says. "In retrospect, I guess I wish I hadn't. I don't mean as a practical matter. I was just as useful at home, and, as a matter of fact, I ended up spending most of the evening on the phone with Charlie Coombs, who stayed at the bank. But just because something like that doesn't happen every day in a banker's life. I'm a creature of habit, I guess. Besides, it's something of a tenet of mine to insist on keeping a proper balance between private and professional life." Although Hayes does not say so, he may have been thinking of something else, too. It can safely be said to be something of a tenet of central bank presidents or governors not to sleep at their places of business. If word were ever to get out that the methodical Hayes was doing so at a time like this, he may have reasoned, it might well be considered just as much a sign of panic as a British bank rate rise on a Monday. Meanwhile, Coombs was making another night of it on Liberty Street. He had gone home the previous night because the worst had momentarily appeared to be over. But now he stayed on after regular work hours with Roche, who hadn't been home since the previous weekend. Toward midnight, Coombs received confirmation of the Export-Import Bank's $250 million credit, which had arrived from Washington during the evening as promised. So now everything was braced for the morning's effort. Coombs again installed himself in one of the uninspiring 11th-floor cubicles, and after a final marshalling of the facts that would be needed for the job of persuading the Continental bankers, set his clock radio for 3:30 and went to bed. A Federal Reserve man, with a literary bent and a romantic temperament, was later moved to draw a parallel between the Federal Reserve Bank that night and the British camp on the eve of the Battle of Agincourt, in Shakespeare's version, in which King Henry mused so eloquently on how participation in the coming action would serve to ennoble even the vilest of the troops, and how gentlemen, safe in bed at home, would later think themselves accursed that they had not been at the battle scene. Coombs, a practical man, had no such high-flown opinion of his situation. Even so, as he dozed fitfully, waiting for morning to reach Europe, he was well aware that the events he was taking part in were like nothing that had ever happened in banking before. 2. So that evening, Tuesday, November 24th, 1964, Hayes arrived at his home in New Canaan, Connecticut, at about 6:30, exactly as usual, having inexorably taken his usual 5:09 from Grand Central. Hayes was a tall, slim, soft-spoken man of 54, with keen eyes framed by owlish round spectacles, with a slightly schoolmasterish air and a reputation for unflappability. By so methodically going through familiar motions at such a time, he realized with amusement, he must seem to his colleagues to be living up to his reputation rather spectacularly. At his house, a former caretaker's cottage of circa 1840 that the Hayeses had bought and remodeled 12 years earlier, he was greeted, as usual, by his wife, a pretty and vivacious woman of Anglo-Italian descent named Vilma, but always called Beba, who loves to travel, has almost no interest in banking, and is the daughter of the late Metropolitan Opera baritone Thomas Chalmers. Since at that time of year it was completely dark when Hayes got home, he decided to forego a favorite early evening unwinding activity of his, walking to the top of a grassy slope beside the house, which commands a fine view across the Sound to Long Island. Anyway, he was not really in a mood to unwind. Instead, he felt keyed up, and decided he might as well stay that way overnight, since the car from the bank was scheduled to call at his door so early the next morning to take him to work. During dinner, Hayes and his wife discussed subjects like the fact that their son Tom, who was a senior at Harvard, would be arriving home the following day for his Thanksgiving recess. Afterward, Hayes settled down in an armchair to read for a while. In banking circles, he is thought of as a scholarly intellectual type. And indeed he is scholarly and intellectual, in comparison with most bankers. Even so, his extra banking reading tends to be not constant and all-embracing, as his wife's is, but sporadic, capricious, and intensive. Everything about Napoleon for a while, perhaps, then a dry period, then a binge on, say, the Civil War. Just then, he was concentrating on the island of Corfu, where he and Mrs. Hayes were planning to spend some time. But before he had got very far into his latest Corfu book, he was called to the telephone. The call was from the bank. There were new developments which Coombs thought President Hayes ought to be kept abreast of. To recapitulate in brief, drastic action to save the pound, which the Federal Reserve Bank not only would be intimately involved in, but would actually join in initiating, was going to be taken by the government banks, or central banks as they are more commonly called, of the non-communist world's leading nations as soon as possible after the next morning's opening of the London and continental financial markets, which would occur between 4 and 5 a.m. New York time. Britain was face to face with bankruptcy, the reasons being that a huge deficit in its international accounts over the previous months had resulted in concomitant losses in the gold and dollar reserves held by the Bank of England. That worldwide fear lest the newly elected Labour government decide, or be forced, to ease the situation by devaluing the pound from its dollar parity of about $2.80 to some substantially lower figure, had caused a flood of selling of pounds by hedgers and speculators in the international money markets. That the Bank of England, fulfilling an international obligation to sustain the pound at a free market price of no lower than $2.78, had been losing millions of dollars a day from its reserves, which now stood at about $2 billion, the lowest point in many years. The remaining hope lay in amassing, in a matter of hours before it would be too late, an unheard-of sum in short-term dollar credits to Britain from the central banks of the world's rich nations. With such credits at its disposal, the Bank of England would presumably be able to buy up pounds so aggressively that the speculative attack could be absorbed, contained, and finally beaten back, giving Britain time to set its economic affairs in order. Just what the sum necessary for rescue should be was an open question, but earlier that day, the monetary authorities of the United States and Britain had concluded that it would have to be at least $2 billion and perhaps even more. The United States, through the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the Treasury-owned Export-Import Bank in Washington, had that day committed itself to $1 billion. The task that remained was to persuade the other leading central banks, habitually spoken of in the central banking world as the continent, even though they include the banks of Canada and Japan, to lend more than $1 billion in addition. Nothing of the kind had ever been asked of the continent before, through the swap network or any other way. In September 1964, the continent had come through with its biggest collective emergency credit so far, $500 million to the Bank of England for use in defending the pound, already embattled then. Now, with this $500 million loan still outstanding, and the pound in far worse straits, the continent was about to be called upon for more than twice that sum, perhaps five times that sum. Obviously, the spirit of cooperation, if not the quality of mercy, was about to be strained. So Hayes' musings that evening may well have run. With such portentous matters churning around in his head, Hayes found it hard to keep his mind on Corfu. Besides, the prospect of the bank car's arrival at 4 o'clock made him feel that he should go to bed early. As he prepared to do so, Mrs. Hayes commented that since he would have to get up in the middle of the night, she supposed she ought to feel sorry for him. But since he was obviously looking forward with keen anticipation to whatever it was that would get him up at that hour, she envied him instead. Down on Liberty Street, Coombs slept fitfully until he was awakened by the clock radio in his room at about 3:30 New York time, that is to say, 8:30 London time and 9:30 farther east on the European continent. A series of foreign exchange crises involving Europe had so accustomed him to the time differential that he was inclined to think in terms of the European day, referring casually to 8 a.m. in New York as lunchtime and 9 a.m. as mid-afternoon. So when he got up, it was, in his terms, morning, despite the stars that were shining over Liberty Street. Coombs got dressed, went to his office on the 10th floor, where he had some breakfast provided by the bank's regular night kitchen staff, and began placing telephone calls to the various leading central banks of the non-communist world. All the calls were put through by one telephone operator, who handles the Federal Reserve Bank's switchboard during off hours, and all of them were eligible for a special government emergency priority that the bank's officers are entitled to claim. But on this occasion, it did not have to be used, because at 4:15, when Coombs began his telephoning, the transatlantic circuits were almost entirely clear. The calls were made essentially to lay the groundwork for what was to come. The morning news from the Bank of England, obtained in one of the first calls from Liberty Street, was that conditions were unchanged from the previous day. The speculative attack on the pound was continuing unabated, and the Bank of England was sustaining the pound's price at $2.78 and 61/100ths of a cent, by throwing still more of its reserves on the market. Coombs had reason to believe that when the New York foreign exchange market opened, some 5 hours later, vast additional quantities of pounds would be thrown on the market on this side of the Atlantic, and more British dollars and gold would have to be spent. He conveyed this alarming intelligence to his counterparts at such institutions as the Deutsche Bundesbank in Frankfurt, the Banque de France in Paris, the Banca d'Italia in Rome, and the Bank of Japan in Tokyo. In the last case, the officers had to be reached at their homes, for the 14-hour time difference made it already past 6 p.m. in the Orient. Then, coming to the crux of the matter, Coombs informed the representatives of the various banks that they were soon to be asked, in behalf of the Bank of England, for a loan far bigger than any they had ever been asked for before. Without going into specific figures, I tried to make the point that it was a crisis of the first magnitude, which many of them still didn't realize, Coombs has said. An officer of the Bundesbank, who knew as much about the extent of the crisis as anyone outside London, Washington, and New York, has said that in Frankfurt they were mentally prepared, or braced, might be a better word, for the huge touch that was about to be put on them, but that right up to the time of Coombs' call, they had been hoping the speculative attack on the pound would subside of its own accord. And even after the call, they had no idea how much they might be asked for. In any event, as soon as Coombs was off the wire, the Bundesbank's governor called a board of managers meeting, and, as things turned out, the meeting was to remain in session all day long. Still, all this was preparatory. Actual requests in specific amounts had to be made by the head of one central bank of the head of another. At the time Coombs was making his softening up calls, the head of the Federal Reserve Bank was in the bank's limousine, somewhere between New Canaan and Liberty Street. And the bank's limousine, in flagrant nonconformity with the James Bond style of high-level international dealings, was not equipped with a telephone. Hayes, the man being awaited, had been president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York for a little over 8 years, having been chosen for the job, to his own and almost everyone else's bewilderment, not from some position of comparable eminence or from the Federal Reserve's own ranks, but from among the swarming legions of New York Commercial Bank vice presidents. Unorthodox as the appointment seemed at the time, in retrospect, it seems providential. A study of Hayes' early life and youthful career gives the impression that everything was somehow intended to prepare him for dealing with this sort of international monetary crisis, just as the life of a writer or a painter sometimes seems to have consisted primarily of preparation for the execution of a single work of art. If divine providence, or perhaps its financial department, when the huge sterling crisis was imminent, had needed an assessment of Hayes' qualifications for coping with this task, and had hired the celestial equivalent of an executive recruiter to report on him, the dossier might have read something like this. Born in Ithaca, New York, on July 4, 1910. Grew up mostly in New York City. Father a professor of constitutional law at Cornell, later a Manhattan investment counselor. Mother a former schoolteacher, enthusiastic suffragette, settlement house worker, and political liberal. Both parents bird watchers. Family atmosphere intellectual, free-thinking, and public-spirited. Attended private schools in New York City and Massachusetts, and was usually his school's top-ranking student. Then went to Harvard, freshman year only, and Yale, 3 years, mathematics major, Phi Beta Kappa in junior year, ineffectual or on class crew. Graduated 1930 as top BA of class. studied at New College, Oxford, as Rhodes Scholar, 1931 to 1933. There became firm Anglophile, and wrote thesis on Federal Reserve policy and the working of the gold standard in the years 1923 to 1930, although he had no thought of ever joining the Federal Reserve. Wishes now he had the thesis, in case it contains blinding youthful illuminations, but neither he nor New College can find it. Entered New York commercial banking in 1933, and rose slowly but steadily. 1938 annual salary, $2,700. Attained title, albeit feeble title, of Assistant Secretary at New York Trust Company in 1942. After a Navy stint, in 1947 became an Assistant Vice President, and 2 years later, head of New York Trust's Foreign Department, despite total lack of previous experience in foreign banking. Apparently learned fast, astounded his colleagues and superiors, and gained reputation among them as foreign exchange wizard by predicting precise amount of 1949 pound devaluation, $4.03 to $2.80, a few weeks before it occurred. Was appointed president of Federal Reserve Bank of New York in 1956, to his utter astonishment and that of New York banking community, most of which had never heard of this rather shy man. Reacted calmly by taking his family on a 2-month vacation in Europe. The consensus now is that the Federal Reserve Bank's directors had almost implausible prescience or luck in picking a foreign exchange expert just when the dollar was weakening and international monetary cooperation becoming crucially important. He is liked by European central bankers, who call him Al, which often comes out sounding more like all, earns $75,000 a year, making him the second highest paid federal official after the President of the United States. Federal Reserve Bank salaries being intended to be more or less competitive in banking terms, rather than in government employee terms. Is very tall and very thin. Tries to observe regular commuting hours and keep his private life sacrosanct as a matter of principle. Considers regular evening work at an office outrageous. Complains that his son has a low opinion of business. Attributes this to reverse snobbery, but even then remains calm. Conclusion, this is the very man for the job of representing the United States Central Bank in a sterling crisis. And indeed, Hayes readily fits the picture of a perfectly planned and perfectly tooled piece of machinery to perform a certain complex task. But there are other sides to him, and his character contains as many paradoxes as the next man's. Although hardly anyone in banking ever tries to describe Hayes without using the words scholarly and intellectual, Hayes tends to think of himself as an indifferent scholar and intellectual, but an effective man of action. And on the latter score, the events of November 25, 1964, seem to bear him out. Although in some ways he is the complete banker, in conformity with H.G. Wells' notion of such a banker, he seems to take money for granted as a terrier takes rats, and to be devoid of philosophical curiosity about it. He has a distinctly unbanker-like philosophical curiosity about almost everything else. And although casual acquaintances sometimes pronounce him dull, his close friends speak of a rare capacity for enjoyment and an inner serenity that seem to make him immune to the tensions and distractions that fragment the lives of so many of his contemporaries. Doubtless, the inner serenity was put to a severe test as Hayes rode in the bank car toward Liberty Street. When he arrived at his desk at about 5:30, Hayes' first act was to punch Coombs' button on his inner office phone and get the Foreign Department chief's latest appraisal of the situation. He learned that, as he had expected, the Bank of England's sickening dollar drain was continuing unabated. Worse than that, though, Coombs said his contacts with local bankers, who were also on emergency early morning vigil, men in the foreign departments of the huge commercial banks like the Chase Manhattan and the First National City, indicated that overnight there had accumulated a fantastic pile of orders to unload pounds on the New York market as soon as it opened. The Bank of England, already almost inundated, could expect a new tidal wave from New York to hit in 4 hours. The need for haste thus became even more urgent. Hayes and Coombs agreed that the project of putting together an international package of credits to Britain should be announced as soon as possible after the New York opening, perhaps as early as 10 o'clock, so that the bank would have a single center for all its foreign communications. Hayes decided to forsake his own office, a spacious one with paneled walls and comfortable chairs grouped around a fireplace, and let Coombs' quarters, down the hall, which were much smaller and more austere, but more efficiently arranged, serve as the command post. Once there, he picked up one of three telephones and asked the operator to get him Lord Cromer at the Bank of England. When the connection was made, the two men, the key figures in the proposed rescue operation, reviewed their plans a final time, checking the sums they had tentatively decided to ask of each central bank and agreeing on who should call whom first. In the eyes of some people, Hayes and Lord Cromer make an oddly assorted pair. Besides being a deep-dyed aristocrat, George Roland Stanley Baring, 3rd Earl of Cromer, is a deep-dyed banker. A scion of the famous London merchant bank of Baring Brothers, the 3rd Earl and godson of a monarch, went to Eton and Trinity College, Cambridge, and spent 12 years as a managing director of his family's bank, and then 2 years, from 1959 to 1961, as Britain's economic minister and chief representative of his country's treasury in Washington. If Hayes had acquired his mastery of the arcana of international banking by patient study, Lord Cromer, who is no scholar, acquired his by heredity, instinct, or osmosis. If Hayes, despite his unusual physical stature, could easily be overlooked in a crowd, Lord Cromer, who is of average height but debonair and dashing, would cut a figure anywhere. If Hayes is inclined to be a bit hesitant about casual intimacies, Lord Cromer is known for his hearty manner, and has, doubtless unintentionally, both flattered and obscurely disappointed many American bankers, who have been awed by his title, by quickly encouraging them to call him Roly. Roly is very self-confident and decisive, an American banker has said. He's never afraid to barge in, because he's convinced of the reasonableness of his own position. But then he's a reasonable man. He's the kind of man who, in a crisis, would be able to grab the telephone and do something about it. This banker confesses that until November 25, 1964, he had not thought Hayes was that kind of man. Beginning at about 6 o'clock that morning, Hayes did grab the phone, right along with Lord Cromer. One after another, the leading central bankers of the world, among them President Carl Blessing of the Deutsche Bundesbank, Dr. Guido Carli of the Bank of Italy, Governor Jacques Brunet of the Bank of France, Dr. Walter Schwegler of the Swiss National Bank, and Governor Per Osprink of the Swedish Riksbank, picked up their phones and discovered, some of them with considerable surprise, the degree of gravity that the sterling crisis had reached in the past day, the fact that the United States had committed itself to a short-term loan of $1 billion, and that they were being asked to dig deep into their own nation's reserves to help tide sterling over. Some first heard all this from Hayes, some from Lord Cromer. In either case, they heard it not from a casual or official acquaintance, but from a fellow member of that esoteric fraternity, the Basel Club. Hayes, whose position as representative of the one country that had already pledged a huge sum, cast him almost automatically as the leader of the operation, was careful to make it clear in each of his calls that his part in the proceedings was to put the weight of the Federal Reserve behind a request that formally came from the Bank of England. The pound's situation is critical, and I understand the Bank of England is requesting a credit line of $250 million from you, he would say, in his calm way, to one continental central bank governor or another. I'm sure you understand that this is a situation where we all have to stand together. He and Coombs always spoke English, of course. Despite the fact that he had recently been taking French refresher lessons, and that at Yale he made one of the most impressive academic records in memory, Hayes doggedly remained a dub at languages and still did not trust himself to carry on an important business conversation in anything but English. In those cases in which he was on particularly close terms with his continental counterpart, he spoke more informally, using a central banker's jargon in which the conventional numerical unit is $1 million. Hayes would say smoothly in such cases, "Do you think you can come in for, say, 150?" Regardless of the degree of formality of the approach Hayes made, the first response, he says, was generally caginess, not unmixed with shock. "Is it really as bad as all that, Al? We were still hoping that the pound would recover on its own," is the kind of thing he recalls having heard several times. When Hayes assured them that it was indeed as bad as all that, and that the pound would certainly not recover on its own, the usual response was something like, "We'll have to see what we can do and then call you back." Some of the continental central bankers have said that what impressed them most about Hayes' first call was not so much what he said as when he said it. Realizing that it was still well before dawn in New York, and knowing Hayes' addiction to what are commonly thought of as banker's hours, these Europeans perceived that things must be grave the moment they heard his voice. As soon as Hayes had broken the ice at each continental bank, Coombs would take over and get down to details with his counterparts. The first round of calls left Hayes, Lord Cromer, and their associates on Liberty and Threadneedle Streets relatively hopeful. Not one bank had given them a flat no, not even, to their delight, the Bank of France, although French policy had already begun moving sharply away from cooperation with Britain and the United States in monetary matters, among others. Furthermore, several governors had surprised them by suggesting that their country's subscriptions to the loan might actually be bigger than those suggested. With this encouragement, Hayes and Lord Cromer decided to raise their sights. They had originally been aiming for credits of $2.5 billion. Now, on reconsideration, they saw that there was a chance for $3 billion. "We decided to up the ante a little here and there," Hayes says. "There is no way of knowing precisely what sum would be the least that would do the job of turning the tide. We knew we would be relying to a large extent on the psychological effect of our announcement, assuming we would be able to make the announcement. 3 seemed to us a good round figure." But difficulties lay ahead, and the biggest difficulty, it became clear as the return calls from the various banks began to come in, was to get the thing done quickly. The hardest point to convey, Hayes and Coombs found, was that each passing minute meant a further loss of $1 million or more to the British reserves, and that if normal channels were followed, the loans would unquestionably come too late to avert devaluation of the pound. Some of the central banks were required by law to consult their governments before making a commitment, and some were not. But even those that were not insisted on doing so, as a courtesy. This took time, especially since more than one finance minister, unaware that he was being sought to approve an enormous loan on an instant's notice with little evidence of the necessity for it, beyond the assurance of Lord Cromer and Hayes, was temporarily unavailable. One happened to be engaged in debate in his country's parliament. And even in cases where the finance minister was at hand, he was sometimes reluctant to act in such a shotgun way. Governments move more deliberately in money matters than central bankers do. Some of the finance ministers said, in effect, that upon proper submission of a balance sheet of the Bank of England, along with a formal written application for the emergency credit, they would gladly consider the matter. Furthermore, some of the central banks themselves showed a maddening inclination to stand on ceremony. The foreign exchange chief of one bank is said to have replied to the request by saying, "Well, this is convenient. We happen to have a board meeting scheduled for tomorrow. We'll take the matter up then, and afterward we'll get in touch with you." The reply of Coombs, who happened to be the man on the wire in New York, is not recorded in substance, but its manner is reported to have been uncharacteristically vehement. Even Hayes' celebrated imperturbability was shaken a time or two, or so those who were present have said. His tone remained as calm and even as ever, but but its volume rose far above the usual level. The problems that the continental central banks faced in meeting the challenge are well exemplified by the situation at the richest and most powerful of them, the Deutsche Bundesbank. Its board of managers was already sitting in emergency session as a result of Coombs' early call when another New York call, this one from Hayes to President Blessing, gave the Bundesbank its first indication of exactly how much it was being asked to put up. The amounts the various central banks were asked for that morning have never been made public. But on the basis of what has become known, it is reasonable to assume that the Bundesbank was asked for $500 million, the highest quota of the lot, and certainly the largest sum that any central bank other than the Federal Reserve had ever been called upon to supply to another on a few hours' notice. Hard on the heels of Hayes' call, conveying this jarring information, Blessing heard from Lord Cromer in London, who confirmed everything that Hayes had said about the seriousness of the crisis and repeated the request. Wincing a bit, perhaps, the Bundesbank managers agreed in principle that the thing had to be done. But right there their problems began. Proper procedure must be adhered to, Blessing and his aides decided. Before taking any action, they must consult with their economic partners in the European Common Market and the Bank for International Settlements, and the key man to be consulted, since he was then serving as president of the Bank for International Settlements, was Dr. Marius W. Holtrop, governor of the Bank of the Netherlands, which, of course, was also being asked to contribute. A rush person-to-person call was put through from Frankfurt to Amsterdam. Dr. Holtrop, the Bundesbank managers were informed, wasn't in Amsterdam by chance. He had taken a train that morning to The Hague to meet his country's finance minister for consultation on other matters. For the Bank of the Netherlands to make any such important commitment without the knowledge of its governor was out of the question. And similarly, the Bank of Belgium, a nation whose monetary policies are linked inextricably with the Netherlands, was reluctant to act until Amsterdam had given its okay. So for an hour or more, as millions of dollars continued to drain out of the Bank of England and the world monetary order stood in jeopardy, the whole rescue operation was hung up, while Dr. Holtrop, crossing the Dutch lowlands by train, or perhaps already in The Hague and tied up in a traffic jam, could not be found. All this, of course, meant agonizing frustration in New York. As morning began here at last, Hayes and Coombs' campaign got a boost from Washington. The leading government monetary authorities, Martin at the Federal Reserve Board, Dillon and Rosa at the Treasury, had all been intimately involved in the previous day's planning for the rescue, and of course part of the planning had been the decision to let the New York Bank, as the Federal Reserve System's and the Treasury's normal operating arm in international monetary dealings, serve as campaign headquarters. So the members of the Washington contingent had slept at home and come to their offices at the normal hour. Now, having learned from Hayes of the difficulties that were developing, Martin, Dillon, and Rosa pitched in with transatlantic calls of their own to emphasize the extent of America's concern over the matter. But no number of calls, from anywhere, could hold back the clock, or for that matter find Dr. Holtrop. And Hayes and Coombs finally had to abandon their idea of having a credit bundle ready in time for an announcement to the world at or near 10 a.m. in New York. And there were other reasons, too, for a fading of the early hopes. As the New York markets opened, the extent of the alarm that had spread around the financial world overnight was only too clearly revealed. The bank's foreign exchange trading desk, on the 7th floor, reported that the assault on the pound at the New York opening had been fully as terrifying as they had expected, and that the atmosphere in the local exchange market had reached a state not far from panic. From the bank's securities department came an alarming report that the market for United States government bonds was coming under the heaviest pressure in years, reflecting an ominous lack of confidence in the dollar on the part of bond traders. This intelligence served as a grim reminder to Hayes and Coombs of something they knew already, that a fall of the pound in relation to the dollar could quite possibly be followed in a kind of chain reaction by a forced devaluation of the dollar in relation to gold, which might cause monetary chaos everywhere. If Hayes and Coombs had been permitting themselves any moments of idle reverie in which to picture themselves simply as good Samaritans, this was just the news to bring them back to reality. And then word arrived that the wild tales flying around Wall Street showed signs of crystallizing into a single tale, demoralizingly credible because it was so specific. The British government, it was being said, would announce a sterling devaluation at around noon New York time. Here was something that could be authoritatively refuted, at least in respect to timing, since Britain would obviously not devalue while the credit negotiations were underway. Torn between the desire to quell a destructive rumor and the need to keep the negotiations secret until they were concluded, Hayes compromised. He had one of his associates call a few key Wall Street bankers and traders to say, as emphatically as possible, that the latest devaluation rumor was, to his firm knowledge, false. "Can you be more specific?" the associate was asked, and he replied, because there was nothing else he could reply, "No, I can't." This unsupported word was something, but it was not enough. The foreign exchange and bond markets were only momentarily reassured. There were times that morning, Hayes and Coombs now admit, when they put down their telephones, looked at each other across the table in Coombs' office, and wordlessly exchanged the thought, "It isn't going to be done in time." But, in the best tradition of melodrama, which sometimes seems to survive stubbornly in nature at a time when it is dead in art, just when things looked darkest, good news began to arrive. Dr. Holtrop had been tracked down in a restaurant in The Hague, where he was having lunch with the Netherlands Minister of Finance, Dr. J.W. Witteveen. Moreover, Dr. Holtrop had endorsed the rescue operation, and as for the matter of consulting his government, that was no problem, since the responsible representative of his government was sitting across the table from him. The chief obstacle was thus overcome. And after Dr. Holtrop had been reached, the difficulties began narrowing down to annoyances, like the necessity